On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love working, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/workingplus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season, we're sitting down with the writer and artists behind the comic book Batman to learn a little bit about how their stories of The Dark Knight come together, from concept to execution. For this episode, we talked to Darren Bennett, who is what's known as a letterer in the comics business. In effect, that means he adds both words and word balloons to the page. While that may seem like a simple task, everything from font choices to the shape of the balloons themselves can have dramatic effects on the ways a reader experiences the printed page. In this episode, Bennett discusses those artistic principles and explores how his choices fit in with the broader creative process of producing a superhero comic. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Bennett shares some thoughts on his favorite fonts and talks about the ones that really drive him crazy. If you're a font person, this Slate Plus Extra is for you. What is your name and what do you do?
I'm Darren Bennett, comic book letterer and owner of End World Design, a comic book lettering studio.
What does that mean exactly? What is the role that a comic book letterer plays in the process of making comic books?
So essentially, the letterer is a role player in comics. You have this sort of system where it's sort of an assembly line system. You have the writer writes out the script, taken to the penciler to do the pencils. Then it either gets inked by the same artist or another artist, which then goes to the colorist and the letterer at the same time. Now, the letterer's role is to put on all of the text that the writer has scripted out. And so basically any of the text that you're seeing on a comic book page is the responsibility of the letterer. So all the cool sound effects, the boom pows and all that stuff, that's also the responsibility of the letterer, as well as the placement of the word balloons and all the dialogue within there.
So we've been talking to a lot of other people involved with that process. But one thing you said that's interesting is that it goes at this stage, it sounds like it almost the process forks somewhat. You said it goes to both the color and the letterer at the same time. How does that work?
Yeah, I think that's more of, you know, with the advent of digital, you know, lettering and coloring, you can sort of do it at the same time rather than have one person do the next step in the job and then hand it off.
Because you're both working from the same scans of the
exactly
page.
Exactly. So the digital file is already formatted, and as long as we're getting the same size format, you can usually marry both the final colors and the final letters together without any problems. There have been situations where, you know, artists aren't working from the same file, and you can cause misalignment there, which tends to be a problem.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you in more detail in a moment about the particulars of your actual part of the process. But before we get into that, I'm curious how you got into this line of work in the first place. How did you become a comic book letterer?
I guess I've always been sort of an artist. Growing up, I wanted to be like the next Walt Disney. Everybody mm-hmm. In my life at the time was
guy with a great signature. Oh, that guy understood letters.
Yeah. So it was really more of an artist thing. I wanted to be an animator uh-huh. originally. And I sort of followed that path as long as I could, and ended up taking on writing as well. And so in around high school, I guess, I decided, you know, comics was the medium for me because it married two of the things that I love, writing and drawing. So mm-hmm. I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design to study sequential art, basically telling stories through images. And from there, just looked around for any kind of job I could find. and a relative of mine was out in L.A. I lived in New Jersey at the time, and they invited me to go over to the Warner Brothers studio to, just interview for a job. And so I took a risk, flew out there and did the interview, but it wasn't panning out fast enough. I had, you know, bills to pay, everything like that. Mm-hmm. And so I kept digging around for different jobs, and I filled out an application or just basically sent out a blind email to the vice president, the COO of Tokyo Pop, which is it was the biggest manga distributor at the time.
They do manga translations of manga, I guess, right?
Yes, basically, yeah. It's Japanese comics that we're localizing in the United States, mm-hmm. and they were the big company at the time. And they brought me in for the job, and I ended up doing lettering on manga first. That was my first foray into lettering. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that all of the nuances in lettering were sort of like something pretty cool. Like I thought of it as a stepping stone into something greater, you know, drawing and writing. But I found that I actually liked it. I liked, you know, playing around with the fonts. And in manga, they have hand-drawn sound effects and hand-drawn balloons and everything like that. And I looked at those things as sort of a new artistic puzzle that I can kind of delve into. And it just really, you know, typography just started becoming something more integrated into my life. And I really found it pretty cool as a way to express myself.
So in this series, we've been talking to a lot of people who worked on one particular issue of Batman, this one, 24, but where Batman famously proposes to Catwoman. But how did you make your way from working on translations of manga to working with DC Comics and all of the artists that are on these books?
It sort of snowballed from that one job, working at Tokyo Pop as a letterer and layout artist there. I found more work, looking for more work in manga, and I ended up talking to the editor over at CMX, which was DC's manga line at the time, and I started working with the editors over there. Jim Chadwick was one of those guys, and he was really, you know, pretty encouraging about my work, and he would offer me opportunities later on down the line when CMX folded up to do, the Western comics. And that's how I familiarized myself with some of the DC editors and everybody mm-hmm. over there. And it sort of just snowballed into more jobs. And the same thing as I was working with different other companies, I'd get recommended for more jobs. And that's how I sort of established myself within the industry.
So how do jobs come to you? Do you have to seek out editors and say, like, hey, I have hours that I could fill up working on your book, or do they come to you at this point?
At this point, I'm fortunate enough that I get enough work coming in. Initially, starting up, I would seek out jobs. Social media was pretty big, where I would go online looking on Twitter, who's looking for a letter, and I'd reach out to various independent artists or independent writers who were looking for things. I was fortunate enough to make connections early in my career that I would get recommended for jobs here and there, and it filled up so fast where people were offering me jobs based on what I'd done before. So once I was finished with another job, then something else would line up, and it was pretty good that way, where I didn't have to always search out for jobs. And now it's more common that I get a lot of work just based on the previous work that I've done.
Were you always a comic book fan? You were into animation, and you found your way in through manga, but were you into superheroes and stuff?
Oh, yeah. More when I was younger, I'd say some of the movies influenced me more, you know, mm-hmm. Superman and things of that nature. I was definitely into cartoons. That was my big thing. But I also read a lot of comic strips instead of mm-hmm. comic books. I was really big into comic strips. I would read Calvin and Hobbes, Garfield, any kind of Sunday funnies, Family Circus. All those things really were my comics at the time. It wasn't until the 90s that I really got heavy into comics. This is around the same time, you know, I entered middle school, high school, mm-hmm. Where Milestone Comics was a big factor. I stumbled upon Milestone. They were pushing diversity and everything like that, and I was drawn to that. I was drawn to the characters they were building, the world that they were building. Mm-hmm. And so that was where I really decided, oh, this is something that I can pursue. This is mm-hmm. where I can tell the stories that I want to tell in a way that I want to tell them.
Yeah. So lettering is one of the parts of the process that is enormously important in producing comics, but that I think also often gets ignored by a lot of fans. There are a handful of letterers who are well known in the 90s. For example, a guy named Todd Klein was mm-hmm. was well known for his work on books like Sandman. But do you feel like you get recognition for what you contribute to these books?
I think it's probably you get more recognition within the industry rather mm-hmm. than from the fandom. It's been a bigger push for letterers such as myself to sort of show what we do mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, just sitting in and letting it just be there. We want to let you know that there's an artist, there's a person responsible for this part of the comic, and it's become an important thing because things like this where I'm sitting here and explaining, I think those are venues and avenues that we're seeking so that the general audience can be aware of what it is that we do, what it is that we bring to a page. Yeah. It's not just, you know, these things just magically appear. You're brought on as a professional to really help tell the story in some way, whether you're adding you know, some sort of level of creativity through the balloon styles, through the art style mm-hmm. that you've established in the, whether it's the sound effects or the captions or whatever. We're bringing something to help tell that story, to help guide the reader through the book. And I think it's important that fans and, you know, some other industry professionals who might not be aware of what it is we do mm-hmm. also become aware, because it is an integral part of making comics.
Yeah. So tell me what a typical day is like for you. It seems like it's a full-time job, but is it a 9-to-5 gig?
A 9-to-5 gig. I wish it was. I try to kind of tame my daily routine. Usually I can be there from morning until well into the next morning, basically. lettering is basically a game of volume, whereas a penciler might be working on one single book. We have to work on multiple books at the same time in order to be successful as letterers. Mm-hmm. So with deadline after deadline, you're constantly trying to manage all of these different projects so that they go out on time. And so I typically start my day, I'll wake up, getting the kids ready for school and everything, and then get my coffee. Coffee's important.
Yeah.
And then I'll go into the office and just start to go through.
Is it a home office or do you have a separate studio?
It's a home office. Yeah. It's originally, yeah, I've moved in the past 2 years, but at my previous home, I was in a closet. I was stuck in a closet. So this is an upgrade. I have a whole room to myself now. Yeah.
Is it like a do you like decorate it with comic stuff or is it like a pretty spare environment in there?
It's fairly decorated. I'd like a little more stuff. I have the walls decorated with different art. I have an Iron Man photo. And then I have toys all around. There's nice. A bunch of He-Man toys. He-Man's my big childhood influence, and so that I have a bunch of Masters of the Universe stuff.
Have you ever lettered a He-Man book?
I have. I was, you know, that was my one of my biggest achievements. I was really excited. I get a lot of licensed properties, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So I get to where I've worked on, you know, Thundercats, Voltron, and He-Man, and these are some of my favorite things to work on because. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so close to my heart that I get to do these things that I, you know, looked up to as a kid. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm definitely pretty fortunate that I got to work on He-Man books through DC and the Thundercats He-Man crossover was nice. Pretty cool too.
Nice. So You're working, I imagine, based on what you've said so far, almost entirely digitally, right? Are you just getting these pages emailed to you? Is that how it starts off?
Yeah. What'll happen is they'll send files via FTP or cloud storage.
Because these are big files, right? They're like,
yeah,
like an issue colors. Might be a gigabyte or something like this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You try and compress down files as much as possible. They don't have to be big, but a lot of artists are sending their layered files and such just so that, you know, they can easily manipulate things in the end. Mm-hmm. When it comes to me, I try to compress them down as much as possible. I'll get a file, and if it's oversized, I can size it down. It's still at print resolution. But I'm basically trying to get it down to a manageable size so that these things can transfer easily, because it is all digital, but you can sort of clog up, file transfers by just having these huge, sure, enormous files. So sure, I try to keep them as small as possible. But yeah, the editors will send me, through different methods, whether it's FTP or, cloud storage, or even email. If they're really small, I'll get inks through email sometimes. And I'll get the script and go to town there.
What program are you working in? What are you using to access the files?
For general comics, I'll use Illustrator. That's the primary. Adobe Illustrator is the primary program for lettering comics. For lettering manga, which I still do, I use Adobe InDesign. They're two different animals, manga lettering versus traditional Western lettering. So the different programs, you try to use the right tool for the right job. And I think InDesign is more catered towards layout, where you can sort of set up the pages a little differently. And you're working with just dropping in text over a series of pages, which helps out manga layout, versus where you're getting a little more creative inside of Western lettering and traditional comic books. You can get more creative. So you want to use something where you can sort of manipulate graphics a little more.
Sure.
And Illustrator's perfect for that.
So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that when you get a manga, since you're working from a translation and there was already text on the page, you're working within the space of the word balloons, text bubbles that are already there on the page, right? Is that the distinction? Whereas my understanding is, when you're working on these American comic books, you're putting everything text-wise on the page, the word balloon and the words themselves.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. For manga, it's already set there. Basically, your job is to kind of stay as true to the original Japanese book or whatever country it's of origin that it's from. You want to stay true to the original style, and that's really that part of the process there. Whereas in American comics, you know, you get to just have your own sort of style choices, whether you're going to do classic rounded balloons or do something a little more more untraditional, and you can make those sort of choices there and just be a little more creative, and mm-hmm. that creative freedom is what draws me to American comics, which is why I wanted to get into American comics after working in manga so long.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, it's your working host, Jacob Rogan, and it is pledge season here at Slate. We want you, the listener, our friends, to help support the show and other Slate podcasts by joining Slate Plus, which you can do at slate.com/workingplus. Here to discuss that with me is Slate Plus editor, Gabe Roth.
Hey, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
So if you have heard any of these segments before, you know we're asking Slate podcast fans who have not yet joined Slate Plus to make that commitment and to join Slate Plus. And the reason we're doing that is we make these podcasts for you, and we hope that you value them. And if you value them, if they're an important part of your media diet, if Working and the other Slate shows, the Political Gab Fest, Trumpcast, the Culture Gab Fest, Slate's parenting podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, just to name a random example. If you value those shows and get something out of them every week, if you go back to them again and again, if they're an important part of your media diet, we want you to help us make them, to help us produce them, and to support them financially.
How much does it cost to help support Slate shows financially, Gabe?
It costs $35 for your first year, $50 per year after that. If you can afford that, we hope you'll say, well, this is something that I value and that I enjoy, and I'm going to step up and pay for it. Obviously, we get revenue from advertising on these podcasts, and that's meaningful, and that's great. But we want a larger share of our revenue to come from the people who listen, to come from the audience and the people who care about what we're making. And those people, in return, they get their podcast without advertising. They get extra segments on a lot of Slate podcasts. They get transcripts of other podcasts, including this one. They get a whole bunch of extra content on the site. They get special podcast miniseries like our Slate Academies and Culture Clubs that are not available to anyone other than Slate Plus members. There's a ton of extra stuff you get that, if you're a real podcast fan, is definitely worth your time. But the main thing we're asking is, if this is content that you value and care for, then we're asking you to step up and support that.
And they can sign up at slate.com/workingplus.
That's exactly right. You want to use slate.com/workingplus so that we know that Working is the show that you're the biggest fan of, and we're having a little contest between the different shows. If you want Jacob to win that contest for Working, go to slate.com/workingplus and sign up for Slate Plus right now.
It would mean so much to us, and it is so important to Slate that people come out and support the work that we are doing at Working and all the other shows for you. Thanks for coming on, Gabe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I think one thing that, you know, probably readers of comics often don't think about is that the shape and style, not just of the words written in on the page, but also of the text balloons themselves, the shape and style of those balloons can affect the way we read the page, the way that we interpret the meaning or the significance of the words that a character is thinking. A spiky edged balloon might indicate that someone's angry. One with kind of scalloped edges could indicate that they're thinking, for example, instead of speaking aloud. Some of those kind of details are just sort of formalized in the grammar of the medium. But do you get much choice? Do you have any kind of freedom when you're working on these books about those kind of details, about the shape and style and maybe even edging of the balloons?
Oh, for sure. And that's part of the thing that letters bring to the book themselves. What a lot of people don't realize is lettering is a form of art like any other. And I liken it to graphic design more than anything else, where you have all these principles in graphic design that you can play with to make the artistic piece, pop and sell. You're doing the same thing in comic books and lettering. You're playing with principles like shape, like you're discussing here, contrast, spatial relationships, white space, negative space. And so you have all of these things balance that you're trying to convey graphically. And you do those sort of things with lettering, and they help to really form the foundation for what the reader is ingesting. Different things like line weights and shape of balloons, they're really choices that the letterer will make. And personally, I make them based on the art that's given to me. So if the artist is really sketchy with their style, really loose, and then I might do something to sort of mimic that, and I'll do thinner line weights around the balloons, or the sound effects won't be as bold and striking. They'll be sort of more whimsical or have that loose quality as well. If they're really tight drawings, with sharp contour, with strong contours and everything. I might do a more bold balloon shape where it's just uniform around the edges. The strokes will be uniform where they don't have that tapering or anything. So it really depends on what the art is giving me. Then that'll help inform my decisions to help design the balloons and sound effects and other things of that nature.
Do you ever have conversations with the penciler or the inker, maybe even the writer, about those choices, or do you pretty much have creative freedom there?
There are times where I'll be in contact with the rest of the creative team, and I think those are the times where you can really tell that the book, there's really a lot of care and put into the book, and the quality shows. Mm-hmm. So I relish in those moments where I get to talk to the artist or the writer and ask their thoughts and opinions on how they want to approach something. Mm-hmm. When they let me know their vision, that helps to inform my ideas. Mm-hmm. And we'll sort of kick off ideas, brainstorm, and see what we can come up with and sort of really achieve what we're trying to do with this book. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, it's really just an isolated thing where the communication is facilitated through the editor. Mm-hmm. They'll be my main point of contact. Mm-hmm. And I'll let them know, you know, some of my choices, and they'll relay that over to the mm-hmm. writer or the artist. And we communicate that way, and that'll sort of shape the identity of the book.
How much time when you're working on a given book would you say on average you spend talking with, communicating with the editor?
It's constant. Every time I finish the first leg of the book, like, we'll go in proofs. Mm-hmm. So I'll run through an initial draft, send it over to the editor, and they'll give it a look and see what they need to change, see what we need to improve, send it back to me. And so we're in constant communication over the whole process from start to finish.
And is that because a lot of what you're doing is literally like laying these words over the art? So is some of that about like moving things around, making sure they're in the right place on the page and such?
Oh, yeah. We definitely, you know, have to be aware of placement, and the editor and the writer as well. The other members of the creative team will have a say in where we want to put things. For the most part, I try to stay out of the art, and I have, mm-hmm. you know, a background in art, so that the artistic sensibility works with me, where I make sure I'm trying not to cover the action or even the quiet moments as much. Because, you know, you really want to let that part breathe. The role of the letterer is secondary, mm-hmm. even tertiary, where you're just there to sort of support what's already there. Mm-hmm. So I definitely am self-aware of where I'm putting the balloons. But, you know, there'll be some times where I might put something where, oh, you know what, that sword is really important in this scene. It's going to play a role later. Can we move that off of can we move that balloon off of there, and so that we can really see that and sell that part?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely a collaborative effort where we're all trying to, you know, really make the book be the best that it can be.
Yeah. So this is maybe like a really remedial dumb question, but do you make your own fonts? I mean, the old school letterers, like, you know, comics artists from the, you know, doing superhero stuff, say in the 60s, they would like write everything out by hand, I think, and they mm-hmm. would literally be cutting out these balloons and pasting them on the art. You're not doing that, obviously. You're doing it digitally. But where does the font come from? Yeah,
the font, for the most part, there are fonts out there. You can go through Comicraft is one of the big names. Blambot is also another font foundry where comic book letterers will go to. I have done my own fonts, and we've done special fonts for different books. Mm-hmm. I think Tale of Sand, which is the book I believe I'm most known for, is it's a Jim Henson piece. And so we spoke with the Henson Company, and they wanted to do something really special with this book. And we all thought that it would be a good idea to sort of use Henson's own handwriting and use that as the dialogue font. And so I was contracted to do the font for the book, and so I did a comic book font based on Jim Henson's handwriting, and you know, it really helped the aesthetic of the book, because it was so integral for that particular piece. And I've done a few fonts as well for other books. just because I really feel like, you know, it's important to match, and not only to match, but to you know, sort of just give that sort of extra embellishment to mm-hmm. the book, where it the font isn't just, you know, picked out willy-nilly. You're really thinking about, why is this important for this book? How does it help the art itself? And so, if it calls for it, I will build a font, but it is time consuming. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that that I haven't done often. I've done maybe four different fonts, and I'll leave the rest to the other foundries and purchase fonts here and there.
Does the script that you get from the writer ever dictate details like that? Like, this person should be in a kind of cursive font, you know, styled font, mm-hmm. or things like that?
Yeah, definitely. With you know, the different characters that are out there, you'll have people who have more of a raspy voice, and so you want to sell that. Mm-hmm. And the writer will leave notes within the script whether they want something, you know, particular for a character. If they want a scratchy voice, or if they want something a little more out of the ordinary, they'll leave a note there and say, or even the shape of the balloon might be in that note, where they want something angular or something a little more wobbly. You know, if a character's sort of woozy or intoxicated or anything like that, they might want that wobbly balloon that indicates that this character's not, you know, functioning normally. Something's wrong here. That'll give the visual indicator to the reader that things are a little off here, and pay attention to this part. And the writer is definitely, you know, self-aware of what he wants to achieve, and conveys that to us as well.
So another really practical question, are you drawing the balloons yourself in the program, or does it have pre-generated balloons that you can use?
In Illustrator is a vector program, so it does have different shapes already created. Mm-hmm. But what I find is that, you know, they're too stiff and not as organic. So I work on a Cintiq. That's a Wacom Cintiq, mm-hmm. Where you can, you know,
a drawing tablet,
use it
basically,
just
like, right?
A drawing tablet, yes. And so you're basically drawing on that tablet. And I use that to create the balloon shapes. Not always. Sometimes I'll use the ellipses from the program and reshape those just a little bit, so they're not as circular. They'll have a little more stretch and pull to them. Hmm. So yeah, you can use the established elliptical shapes, or, you know, do something a little more organic. And I find the organic stuff sort of helps with the art style a little more often than not.
Hmm. So when a page first comes to you, to kind of return to that, when you first are looking at the thing you're going to work on, you have inked art, panel layouts, all of that. You've also got the script from the writer, from which you're going to decide what goes where, but it may be sketchy about, say, the placement of the word balloons within a given panel, right? You just know mm-hmm. how many balloons are going to be, how much space they have to fill and such. What's the first thing you do once you've looked at all that? Do you read the script all the way through before you get going, or are you just working one page, one panel at a time?
It's more of a one page, one panel at a time format. I hardly ever read the script. As soon as that's sent, it's mostly once I have the art, I'll look at the art and sort of brainstorm for ideas there. I think that's a little more in my priority list. What I want to accomplish with the lettering is to look at the art and sort of you know, familiarize myself with that as much as possible to get a foundation for what I want to do creatively there. Mm-hmm. And so I'll take a look at the art, go through each of the pages, see what's there. And I'll also look at the art for technical things. I think that's part of the letterer's job that is sort of lost upon people who aren't aware of what the job is, that we are responsible for a lot of the formatting there. If a page is not to spec, I'll talk with the editor and just make sure we're getting a page that is, you know, standard comic book size. And make sure that the letters can line up and within the safety. I believe I was listening to one of the artists, David Finch, and mm-hmm. he was talking about having the bleed and the trim and the
ways
margins.
That the art extends over the edge of the printable page, right?
Exactly. And so as letterers, we also have to be aware of that, where we can stay within the margin so that we're not having anything close to the trim, and be aware of the bleed so that nothing is cut off. That's really important there. Mm-hmm. And so, I'll take a look at the art for things like that, for the technical aspects and for the creative aspects as well. And then once I get the first page into my template, I'll usually drop them into a pre-made template that has some general balloons that I use as a baseline, and then use those and trying to figure out where I want to go from here. Mm. And I'll set up that first page, determining the font that I want to use, determining the balloon shapes that I want to use, and general style, things like that. And do that first page. If it's a first issue, or if it's, the first time I'm working on a book, I'll probably send over to the editor or to the creative team and see if, this is something that they approve of. Mm-hmm. And once I get feedback on that, well, then I'll work through the rest of the pages.
Generally speaking, how long does it take you to do a given page? I mean, I'm sure it depends on the amount of text and all of that, but is there a kind of average time frame that you shoot for to maintain your working schedule?
I shoot for 6 pages an hour.
Okay.
So however that works out mathematically. Yeah, 6 pages an hour. I can usually finish a 22 comic book project within around 5 hours, the 5 hour mark. If I'm taking more than 5 hours, the project must have a lot of extra things going on there, whether it's overly wordy or something like that. But if I'm more than 5 hours in, or conversely, it might not just be something problematic. It might be something where I'm doing extra creatively because the art calls for it. Where I might do some hand drawn stuff. Where there are times where I'll jump out of Illustrator, go into Photoshop or Clip Studio, and draw out some of the sound effects myself and bring those back into Illustrator and manipulate those there. Hmm.
Are you copying the words directly over, like copying and pasting words from the script, or do you have to retype it into Illustrator or the other programs that you're using?
The script is copy-pasted. That's very key. I think, a lot of people might not realize that, but it, in this digital age, everything is boom, boom, boom. We have to be really fast. And if I'm retyping, we might as well just go back to hand lettering where I'll write out every letter.
Yeah.
But basically, and there's more cause for concern because, I'm retyping it, I might make a mistake there. Mm-hmm. So we'll get, occasionally somebody will send a PDF script. Mm-hmm. Where the words you can't copy paste from the PDF unless it's OCR ready, and if you're trying to copy if you're trying to send me a PDF script and I can't copy paste from it, I'll usually request a Word doc or a RTF mm-hmm. that I can copy paste from, because we'll run into tons of problems if you let me copy paste a script.
Sure. What about copy editing? I mean, do you have to look over the work once you've finished a page to make sure that everything is in the right place and in the right order?
I'll do a once over, as far as, balloon placement and things like that, and to make sure things are aligned, whether we have balloons butted to the borders, mm-hmm. Make sure those things are in order. Colors are within gamut, within, CMYK, printing colors. I'll do once over for things like that. As far as grammatical or text things, there are some things I touch, some things that I don't. One, because I'm not a professional editor. Where mm-hmm. while I pride myself on writing skills and knowing some grammar, there are definitely things that I'm not aware of, where I'll leave that to the editor to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. But let's say things like. There are certain companies have their own style, manual styles, where I know, okay, well, this ellipse shouldn't have a space after it. Mm-hmm. So I'll close up all those spaces. Or, if there are breath marks, those are the little whiskers outside of, size and grumbles or things like that, mm-hmm. if you've seen it in comics, where they'll have spaces between them and we'll close those up. So things that I'm you know, aware of that I can change, that I can make that call on, I'll do those. But the rest of it, I'll leave, just because I don't want to make a mistake of saying, oh, well, this is grammatically incorrect, this needs a comma. But in the end, they don't necessarily need the comma.
Do they ever catch things like, do the editors at the comics production houses ever catch things like that after you've done your lettering and that you then have to go through and fix in your work, in the work?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I'm only human, so I'm definitely not going to catch everything. And they'll definitely point out, you know, when I've made, you know, lost something that I should have caught. Mm-hmm. So there are other opportunities for always improving and always making sure that you're sort of, you know, doing this quality control check before you send that out, because you'll end up looking at the final product and be like, oh man, I wish I would have caught that. And so definitely you want to be self-aware, but you do rely on the rest of the team. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I love about comics. It's a total team effort, and having, you know, that support base where everybody can sort of check and balance out each other, then that's, you know, one of the best things I love about this industry.
You know, one thing that I'm thinking about as I listen to you talk is that some of what you do is not unlike, say, introducing lineation into poetry, breaking a phrase up into lines, where you can jam a phrase and suddenly suggest another meaning that gets transformed or changed by the next one. I mean, do you have to think about the rhythms of language, the sound of it, these kinds of issues, as you think about how to organize the word balloons on a page?
Oh, definitely. One of the things that will happen is maybe the writer is trying to convey something. Maybe he wants a beat or a pause in a certain situation. There's a silent panel, or there should be a moment of silence or something that really create that either tension or comedy for comedic effect. And there are opportunities to sort of use lettering to help convey that message, that idea. And so there are times where I'll interpret a page, or try to interpret what the writer or the artist wants to do, because sometimes those things change from script to the art. The writer might have called for something where it's a character really yelling, right, and just really fired up, but the art may have not been drawn to that dramatic effect. And so whereas in the script it might say this character, that usually if you're trying to indicate in a script that some text should be big and loud for emphasis, it'll be in all caps or something. Mm-hmm. And so when I go to the art and I look at the page, and maybe the character is not as animated, or he's a little more subdued, I might not add that big, bold, emphasized text and create something a little softer. And like the same thing with a pause, I might break up the word balloons in a way where it'll create that stretch of breath. We'll use tail connectors to sort of determine that, or maybe an empty word balloon that you know, sort of indicates there's nothing being spoken, or just complete silence and decide on that.
You worked on issue 24 of Batman, that proposal issue, right?
Yes.
So in that proposal issue that you did with Tom King and David Finch, Danny Mickey, Seth and Clay Mann, do you remember any particular challenges or interesting details that came up in the course of that five-hour day, I assume, that you spent on that? Or five-hour part of a day?
5 hours, yeah. It was really... I think working on Batman is fun because, and I tweeted this out that day I was working on it, because I was so excited. It's more so than other books, a lesson in designing word balloons and designing the page. As I mentioned, you know, it's sort of like graphic design, and I was really, you know, focused on that aspect when I was working on that particular book. there's this one page. It's not a double page spread, but it is across, you know, two pages. I think it's like 6 and 7, where there's I created this sort of semicircle of the word balloons across the two pages. And it would, you know, it's not something that somebody asked for. It's not something, you know, that was called for in the script or the artist or anyone said to do this. But I thought it created a nice balance and a nice rhythm. And I do that throughout the book, where I'm creating these rhythmic lines through the using the balloons to kind of shape the page. Mm. David likes to do these overlapping panels, so I look at that and say, oh, well, what can I do with this? And so I'll overlap some of the panels with some of the captions to kind of mimic that, mm-hmm. and create that movement through the page.
It produces that drama that David is trying to convey, I think, with that, that sense of dynamically overlapping panels.
Yeah, it definitely does. And so you're trying to sort of do this within the limitations of the page. You don't want to cover too much art, like I was saying. You want to be in this sort of left to right motion, so you'll have to sort of undulate the word, the captions and the balloons as best as possible within this this frame to create that look that you're trying to go for. So yeah, there were a lot of moments like that where I was trying to really do something that helped along. There's a page I think it might have been another page not by David by Seth or where there was this curvilinear perspective.
Mm-hmm. That vertiginous shot where you're looking down on the two characters on the top of the building.
Oh yeah, yes. And so I wanted to let that breathe as much as possible, but I also wanted to sort of follow that shape. And so the tail itself became something that I was working with there. Yes. And so the balloon that's going towards one of the, I believe it's Claire speaking, with the tail that's going to her, it sort of follows this curve. Usually I'll do more straightened tails. They'll have a softer curve. But this one I did a little more exaggerated because I wanted to follow that perspective there. And so things like that were just jumping out to me, and I really wanted to do something dynamic with the book, and I really hope, you know, it helped out the book.
Yeah. Well, you also have an interesting dynamic in that book, which is that there were two separate teams of artists who told the two stories, but the narrative, the text that we're reading, often overlaps. You know, you hear dialogue from one story while you're looking at the images of another. You say that you're really informed in your choices and your design work by the art that you're looking at. Did having two different art styles in the book affect that?
Not as much. I thought, in that particular book, I think the story itself, as you say, we're looking at something going on in Batman's life, where he's going rooftop to rooftop with Catwoman, juxtaposed with his dialogue with Claire. I think that sort of helped that idea, where I didn't have to worry so much about, you know, managing the two different art styles. And obviously, you know, it already has an established look to the book, where I'm not going to stray too much from art style to art style. Hmm. But I would do certain things on, like I said, with the curvilinear perspective on Seth's pages. I did certain things there, whereas on Danny's with the overlapping panels. And so these, I think those different little smaller ideas, hmm. were placed within the framework of the individual page rather than this overarching theme that I created. Mm-hmm. It was more, you know, from page to page, what can I do here?
Yeah. So to return to the larger issues, you say it takes about 5 hours to do a book on average. So that means you're doing 1.5 to 2 a day usually?
If it works out that way. I also run a lettering studio with, 7 other staff letterers. So a lot of my day is consumed by project management.
Okay. And is that all comics work, or are you doing other stuff in that lettering studio?
It's mostly comics work. It's primarily comics. We do also do children's books, but and design for different sort of other publishing venues. But it's primarily comics work, where I have five of my guys. They work on lettering different books, and so I'm really sort of managing that. Whether I'm looking at proofs from them to kind of give them feedback, so that we maintain the established house style. Mm-hmm. A lot of my day is also spent doing day to day things like responding to clients, and on a given day, I can be working on a single book, but also sort of doing management for other projects as well. Like I said, I've got my hands on, I'd say we're juggling maybe around 40 projects a month.
Wow.
And so, so really taking care of those takes up the majority of what I want to do. And so it's not always lettering the comic that takes the most time. I think a lot of people know, a lot of the editors and people in the position to hire know that lettering doesn't take really long. It shouldn't take days, months, or whatever or whatever have you. So scheduling, they might think, I can give him this and he can turn this around by tomorrow. But it doesn't always work like that, because there are other things that are other factors, whether you're working on another book to letter or whether you have other projects going on. I'd usually say if I get 2 days notice on a book, I'm good to go. I can jump on that and make sure that's going to meet deadline. I'd prefer longer, obviously, but give me 2 days and I can make it happen.
Yeah.
So that 5-hour day might stretch over a period of time.
It sounds like the financial part of it must be really complicated, since you're managing a studio, working with contracts with different companies and so on all at once.
Yeah. It's something that I didn't anticipate going into business for myself. It's definitely something that I'd broach to people who want to jump into this career, or any freelance career for that matter. It's a business just like anything else. And
yeah.
So you're becoming a business, and where you're having to do all of that. You're having to do your own customer service. You're having to do your own taxes and financial department. You're being all of the departments for one business, mm-hmm. Into a singular person. And, the financial aspect definitely plays a role, where I have to be concerned with keeping the books, keeping records, handling the taxes, handling other finances, whether the day-to-day purchases and things like that. But also when you have to do anything credit based, it becomes a real task. Every time I have to, like I said, I bought a house a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and that's a bigger bigger hoops to jump through, rather than when they're just asking for normal pay stubs. I can't provide normal pay stubs.
Right.
So it becomes something a little larger than just, here's my paperwork, let's go. And both my wife and I are self-employed, so it's even more difficult.
Yeah.
Finding things like healthcare, that's a little more challenging, because we're not under a company umbrella. Mm-hmm. We have to actually go out there and search through different healthcare companies.
Yeah. I mean, that speaks to a change, I think, within the comics industry as a whole. I as I understand it, in the older days, letterers would have often been in-house. In some cases, going really far back, artists themselves might have done some of the lettering. But the more distributed business that we see now, where someone like you is working for a bunch of different comics companies and publishing houses and things, leads to a really different model that affects the way that someone like you can conducts your life, lives your life.
Mm. Yeah. There was a couple of years ago where I read this book, The E-Myth Principle, and it sort of described how small businesses, what small businesses fail from what succeed. And one of the things that drew my interest was this factor of being the technician versus being the business itself, having a business worldview. And I sort of took that to heart, where at the time I was the business. I was, I'm the person, responsible for everything. If I couldn't work, there's no revenue coming in, right? Mm-hmm. And so that really scared me, because as a father, as a family man, I have to be able to provide for my family. If something happens, how do I monetize this? How do I do that? And so, trying to separate my life from the actual business and turn it into something else, which is why I established the studio itself, was really important to me. And I looked at that and how do I make this something where there can be a steady revenue stream and be something where I'm speaking with multiple clients, speaking with, not just, you know, becoming a single house letter. I can offer services to multiple clients and make a living.
Yeah. Well, I want to let you go soon, but I also want to ask this. What's the most satisfying part of lettering comics for a living? What do you like about this job?
What do I like about this? I like it's comic books, you know? It's fun. It's such a fun industry. And you know, just being I don't have to call it work. Mm-hmm. I get to do something that I love. I get to play with characters, play in worlds that I love, and you know, get to be a part of this bigger pop culture phenomenon. You know, I can talk to family members and they'll ask me what I do, and I'm not necessarily strangers, family members, whoever. They ask, well, what are you doing nowadays? And when I let them know, yeah, I'm working on Batman. That's you know, their eyes light up.
Yeah.
You know, even with this. This issue we're discussing, issue 24 of Batman, and that iconic moment with Catwoman, my daughter, who pays no interest in me whatsoever, she doesn't care. She could, you know, be far from excited about anything her dad works on. She says, "Hey, did you know that Batman proposed to Catwoman?" And I opened up my page where I lettered him on his knees, and she was like, "Wow, you did that!" That was a highlight for me.
Yeah,
know, just things like that. It's yeah. just being part of this larger culture, and it's just so fun. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
This has been really great. It's so fascinating to learn about this stuff, and I'm really excited to share it with people. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'd love to hear your thoughts about Working. Our email address is working@slate.com, and I do read and respond to those emails as often as I can. I try to get to all of them. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. This episode wouldn't have been possible without production assistance from AC Valdez, Afim Shapiro, and Verilyn Williams. It was edited by Benjamin Frisch.